you're seeing that the used modules are in many cases going and feeding other underserved markets. And then you have commodities coming within the US market within the urban mining conversation. And that is feeding yet another industry. So this is the feedstock to a lot of different conversations in production and accessibility to renewable energy to other markets.
Welcome back to the Clean Techies Podcast, where we interview the top climate tech founders and investors to share their stories, advice, and lessons when it comes to building and investing in climate. Curious about what happens to solar panels when they are no longer usable? Maybe you really want a good answer to your crazy uncle next time you meet him about what happens to all these solar panels when they're done. Well, look no further. Today, we are speaking with Adam Saghai, founder and CEO of We Recycle Solar, and we are discussing all things end of life for solar panels, including how circular can we make the supply chain? What are the OEMs able to learn about their product's end of life through partnering with We Recycle Solar? What are the real lifespan of solar panels? How is this reality affecting investor returns, refurbishing and reselling solar panels? How investors are even getting early upgrades in order to make a higher return, despite the additional CapEx. And finally, how We Recycle is targeting to process 500,000 panels in 2024. Learn about this and more on today's episode. Enjoy the episode and don't forget to stick around for our takeaway section at the end of the show. Awesome. Welcome to the show, Adam. How's it going?
It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm excited to chat. Obviously, before I was giving you a bit of crap for saying it's cooling down in Arizona when it's still really warm. But hey, it's all relative, right?
Absolutely. If you ever want to know someone truly cares about you, loves you, they will visit you in Yuma, Arizona, in July. So
I would say if they really care about you, they tell you to leave. but fair play, man. I guess different strokes for different folks. But tell us, give us a really like a high level background. You know, who are you and what are you working on? Just we'll get into the nuances, but give us a high level overview.
Absolutely. So Adam Saghai, CEO of We Recycle Solar. It is exactly as it's stated. We are in the business of managing excess, overstock, and end of life solar panel and solar panel equipment. Within that conversation, we do a little bit more than just recycle solar panels. We have a decommissioning team that will go out and take commercial utility farms down, package them, bring them back to our plant in Yuma, Arizona. And that's where all the magic happens. We either look to reuse and refurbish solar panels and get them to secondary market, or we look to break them down if economically, it doesn't make sense to refurbish them, and we look to extract valuable commodities from them and put them back in supply chain.
Okay, nice. So we'll get into that. I guess broadly speaking, I mean you've kind of answered the problem, but it sounds, I usually ask people the second question is, what problem are you solving? So can you just give us a high level overview of this kind of process and why it's a new problem, or maybe it's not new, it's just that you're the first one to solve it. Talk about it a bit.
Absolutely. So great question. And with renewable energy being one of the greatest sustainable forms of energy out there, especially solar, we got into the business knowing that there was no solution for end of life. So here is this great technology, great usage, good application, but no one actually thought of what how do we manage the waste? And so that's where we came in, and we were inspired to get some very technical people, some brilliant people, and put them on a team to solve this problem.
Were there any, everybody knew if you're going to be building a whole bunch of solar panels and putting them out, there's going to be something that need to be done. So did people just say, hey, we know we'll figure it out later because humanity likes to solve problems? Or was there somebody who had thoughts around, oh, we should probably start working on this? Like, just why did you get in earlier, it seems, than most people? Because I don't know of other companies doing this. There maybe are, but definitely not as popular.
No, I mean, in 2019, when we first started this, I think there was so much money, there was so much conversation around development, manufacturing, getting this great technology in the hands of the masses. And I think what ended up happening is that, you know, all the money and all the appeal was on that side of the business. And typically within reverse logistics, returns management, and waste or recycling, it's not as sexy as a conversation, right? And so it is very expensive rather, and resource intensive. And, you know, that's not that wasn't the focal point. And so one of the things that we saw was there wasn't put too much thought into it. And right around 2019, we started to see the first surge of panels. COVID happened, and, you know, our team said, we need to find a scalable option because this issue is just going to grow year over year. Mm-hmm. And so that's really the main push.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. I have a lot of people they tend to be like, oh, you know, the people from where I'm from, they're like, oh, you're going to build all these things. What are you going to do with them? They're just going to sit there. It's like, no, I mean, everybody finds a use for something eventually. Right. So I think it's a little bit of just a lack of optimism there, but I guess you've talked about kind of these things with why you started and the problem and the timing. And can you talk about any particular data points you have on what you're seeing on the ramp up of kind of panels having to be taken down and replaced or whatnot? Can you just talk about some of those data points?
Sure. So we look at the current landscape, and there's about 500 million panels installed in the U.S. today. And we're seeing the metrics somewhere around 22% growth. Regular growth that's happening within the sector. One of the things that the data points that we are collecting personally from an end of life standpoint, we're seeing the space grow much faster than, say, the initial NREL report that was published. A lot of those figures that were within that report back in 2016 did not factor some of the larger conversations around incentives and some of the weather related issues that may be happening. Mother Nature is taking a toll on a lot of these resources. So we're seeing the space grow. I would say it's 50% greater and 5 times sooner than expected.
And that's when you say the growth, the 20% growth, that's referring to the growth of the solar industry, not necessarily the number of panels coming off, correct?
No, that's end of life. So we're seeing, personally within our organization, we're seeing a growth even from last year with the number of panels that are getting placed back into end of life. We're seeing, you know, 20 to 30%. I mean, you're seeing this year over year, you're seeing a lot. Yes. And that, it's compounding, right? So it's pretty extensive.
So I guess the first thing that comes to my mind, and maybe you might be better to do this, but in general, with the whole idea of solar as an energy source, right? It's very cheap to do right now compared to especially other conventional forms of energy based off of the numbers that they ran, right? Which was, correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, but like 20 year roughly lifespan of these panels. They're going to generate X amount of money. So, you know, they're just getting a certain amount. Usually, I don't know the exact rates, but like really a small amount of like a few cents per kilowatt, right? But they're producing a lot of it over a long period of time. If what you're saying is true, right, the capital investment in these panels is wrong, right? It's not 20 years, it's 15 years. Did they already factor in some loss to damage already? Like, is this going to change the financial model substantially, where solar becomes now no longer cost competitive or, you know, the best dollar value for energy projects?
So I think that's a great question. And I love that question. And for many reasons, one, it does allow folks to kind of look at the financial model and look at the longevity of it. The yield is still there. I mean, again, one of the things that we have to factor in is the technology as it advances is getting cheaper and cheaper. Right now in Asia, panels brand new with warranty, 25-year plus warranties are going for 10 cents a watt. I mean, it's unheard of, right? Although the U.S. Is seeing much, you know, the highest cost in manufactured panels in the world, still, you have so many incentives in place to incentivize all the asset owners. I do believe they're getting the returns they want, but it's like anything else. Look, you're a consumer. The iPhone 46 comes out and you're going to go get it and you'll trade in your iPhone 40, right? Or whatever the latest and greatest is. So you're seeing that from my standpoint, from a holistic standpoint, from a circular economy, it is feeding the used modules are in many cases going and feeding other underserved markets. And then you have commodities coming within the US market within the urban mining conversation. And that is feeding yet another industry. So this is the feedstock to a lot of different conversations in production and accessibility to renewable energy to other markets. But again, taking it back to your point, I think that asset owners are constantly looking for efficiencies and, you know, better returns. So if you have 100,000 square foot rooftop Walgreens or Sam's Club application, rooftop application, and you were running on 300 watts panels that you have up there for 15 years or so, now you're getting 600 watt panels. Well, you just doubled your return rate, right? Theoretically. So a lot of it is has to do with putting your best assets to get the best return. But from a longevity standpoint, we're seeing panels that are 30 plus years old that are still working. They have about 70% efficiency output. So, I mean, these are the technology works, right? It's just the technology is moving at such a fast pace that it may outpace some of the financial models, and so they're getting the returns that they want.
Interesting. And so when you, just to go back on one clarification, when you mentioned that even they're still getting the returns they want, even if it's a shorter lifespan than they expected, is that that's minus the incentives or in, when you include the incentives into it?
Depending on when you, you know, when you have that conversation, again, because they do change, I think that even within those incentives, you know, this is still a very, what I believe a very profitable industry to be in. And again, we're not in the development conversation or end of the business, but we often see early upgrades because they want better efficiency. You know, they want the highest wattages per square foot, right? That they're working with. And now that technology is cheaper than it was before, and it's giving them even a higher rate of return on their investment.
We are excited to announce that we have launched a Patreon. You can find this newly linked in our Substack and audio platform descriptions. We are both really just so grateful for each and every one of you and wanted to create a way to interact with you and for you to support us on our journey as we continue and try to talk to the best people doing amazing things in climate tech. We do all of this on the time we can muster outside of our day jobs, so any support means the world. Now, gushing over, back to the show.
That's interesting. Okay, that is interesting. So the next question I have is really around, you mentioned you're taking these panels and sometimes breaking them down depending on the circumstances and then taking those minerals, those materials, putting them elsewhere, but you mentioned the secondary market. Was this something that was factored into the financial plan of these projects where like, okay, we're going to have to pay X amount to get rid of these down the road, or, and is that how it's working out, or are they actually making a bit of money by selling them on the secondary market? How does that work out for the developer, the project owner, I should say?
So we're seeing, you know, we end up working hand in hand with a lot of the developers, and we do go into what would be considered a decommissioning plan or planning rather. And a lot of those engineering reports will have some of those things factored. They will factor in if that panel can be resold at the end of life or it would need to be recycled. And from my understanding, that side of the business, they account for all of this. They are accounting for end of life, whether it gets resold or it gets recycled.
Okay, nice. And so you mentioned a couple of things that I don't know if I understand this very well. You can refurbish the panels and like clean them up a bit to get them reusable for other applications and to sell them at a discount compared to brand new. Is that correct?
Absolutely. It is remarkable how this industry from a reverse logistics standpoint is impacting the world's understanding of how to energize some of these remote areas of the world. We're seeing everything from do-it-yourselfers, you know, guys that are putting on RVs, to folks that are sending it to, say, Puerto Rico, where they have hurricanes and they're affected by natural catastrophes year over year. And we're able to refurbish them. We're able to test them and remarket them to secondary markets, which If they had to go to the open market for brand new panels, they could save up to about 70% of the cost.
And in that model, are you the one, since you're providing that service, are you kind of taking a cut of the sale for the project owner, or are you getting paid to dispose of it and then you kind of do the refurbish and then you sell it?
So we work in many ways. We have a profit sharing model in the instance that the asset owner says, look, we're going to do an early upgrade, or, you know, we are going to retire these assets. We will either give them a credit, or in some cases that, you know, and take it off the recycling charge for other assets they have, or we'll just write them a check and say, okay, we're going to buy these assets from you. We take them in, refurbish them, and then sell those for a profit, after our expenses.
Okay. Nice. I love these. I see this is the circular economy is just so fascinating. Like you got to get a bit creative, but I really like it. On this same topic of recycling and reusing, how can you talk to us about how much of the materials from these solar panels, when you have to break them down and like kind of put, you know, take them down to their essence, let's call it, how much of that can be then reused in manufacturing new panels, or does it have to go to other areas of the supply chain for other goods?
Here's my professional opinion as of today. So I believe that within the next 2 to 5 years, we will be able to inject some of this raw commodity back into the supply chain that's directly affecting the solar industry. Today, that is not possible. And that is due to the feedstock. So for instance, you know, if I'm trying to put it into a, you know, take the material to make, you know, glass or even aluminum frames for, say, a Series 6, you know, for a solar panel, I would need the same consistency and I would need millions of them. And right now, the market is just not there. We're seeing a lot of different varying models, and we're getting this at a very sporadic rate. We're not seeing 500,000 of the same asset with the same compounds and the same ingredients, if you will, right? Because you need that consistency in manufacturing. So they are going to secondary markets that may take the raw aluminum or the glass, and they may go through another process to be utilized for a specific use, not for solar manufacturing.
Okay, got it.
And that's today. That could happen. You know, again, I believe in the next 2 to 5 years, we're going to see, based on volume, we'll be able to use that as feedstock, but not today.
So broadly speaking, what has to happen to make that possible is not innovation per se. It's just that there's just not enough supply currently, because you need, like, this manufacturer needs a certain thing, so they can only use the materials from their own panels to go back in. You couldn't just take, you know, somebody else's and send it to another place that they can buy it, right? You can't conglomerate them. Is that correct?
You can do that. You can. It's a little bit of both. So it literally has to do a little bit of both. I think that the technology, the processing, is going to get refined. The industry is very young. We are very few companies that are doing this. And then on the other flip side, I think that the feedstock and consistent feedstock, where, you know, we may get 5 trucks of this and 3 trucks of that and 7 trucks of it.
Yeah.
You need your lines to run consistently on the same chemical compounds.
It makes me wonder in some ways, like, because they have, you mentioned that the innovation in the panels space has kind of increased, the efficiency is better, they're making a lot more energy, they're producing a lot more energy. But that's obviously comes with really kind of nuanced and innovative ways of building them and how they what the feedstocks are. But in the long run, does it make more sense to have maybe a less powerful panel that is more simple to make that you can recycle many times? Or is it better to try to focus on that efficiency, right? Kind of an interesting thing to consider for circularity in general.
Wow, what an interesting question that is, right? So now you're cannibalizing the whole conversation around manufacturing. You know, look, I think there's going to be some type of work collaboration from end of life with manufacturing, how to design for end of life. So to your point, it may become like Legos, where you're taking certain parts out. or maybe you're not adding certain adhesives that are more challenging to take apart. And so it can be done, but let's not forget that these assets are made to hold up in all kind of extreme conditions. So there is some of that happening right now. We're working with manufacturers to redesign some of their product line to be easier recycled. And so that work is being done, but we're at the very beginning of this.
Oh man, it's so fascinating, isn't it? Because they've already done a good job of making the product, right? Now, when they get that feedback loop, it's like building software now, right? You can now iterate.
Yep.
Obviously, not quite as quickly because you still have to see how it plays out in the long term, but they can make a lot of differences based on understanding your process, which didn't exist really before, right? Nobody was at scale doing this, right? So this is really interesting. I like this a lot. We kind of talked about it a bit before, but we'll go back to it. So tell us more about the original idea to start WeRecycle Solar. Like, how did you decide about this? Tell us a little bit more about what you were doing before and how it led to this.
So, you know, our original background with our previous company was reverse logistics, returns management, and e-waste. So we were handling essentially all of the electronic waste that was coming into the different waste streams. And one of the things that we incorporated early on within that business is the concept of circularity before it was even sexy. So how do we take a laptop and refurbish it? And how do we get several uses out of one product? And, you know, one of the things that's interesting is when you look at any industry, if you have a reverse logistics concept, and many industries do, I think in the IT and electronic space, they do. And you do with cars as well. You go to a used car lot and you buy a used car and it's certified, and they have a reverse logistics concept built in. We thought that we could bring value to this space. And one of the things that I'm extremely proud of is, you know, back in 2019, the concept and idea and the pilot scale plant that we were working on and the R&D, it led us to believe that it can be done. And it is such a refreshing conversation to have with people to say, this industry is closed loop. It has figured it all out. You have this green, sustainable energy, and now you have a solution to bring it back to life and reutilize almost every component of that asset. And then you have this secondary, you know, you have this other conversation on the secondary market where there are places in the world that do not have legitimate power. They in villages and remote areas. And now you're bringing access through a low cost alternative method where they don't have to go into what would be the grid. They can be self-sufficient. I think you're going to find that people will live in different areas. It will create access to opportunity, to education. I mean, it's going to really, the ripple effects are going to be huge within the industry that we are creating. And there's other companies like us now that are getting into the space with manufacturers now taking place with returns management programs. It's the very beginning, but I'm extremely excited and thrilled to say that we were at the forefront and we started this trend.
Hey guys, we need your help with something. In order to better understand what you like most about the show, what you dislike, and how we can help you, please take 7 minutes to fill out our listener survey if you haven't already. It only takes about 7 minutes, but it will drastically improve our ability to give you the best content that you're looking for. Thanks for your help. Now back to the show. Yeah. No, this is cool. I mean, I love these types of things. When you kind of realized that this was an opportunity and you wanted to work on it, can you talk more about how you actually started? So it sounds like you had some level of infrastructure kind of on the refurbishing, kind of recycling space. You can tell us a bit more about that. But how did you actually like get your first client? How did it work? Like, talk us through that process.
Absolutely. So early on, we were contacted by a manufacturer. I think their biggest concern was, hey, there's no solution out there. And one of the things that they were embarrassed to say where they were landfilling some of the waste that they had for manufacturing. And the conversation then came to, great, why don't we help you either get some value back or eliminate some of your costs, your disposal costs. And working with them, we realized, wait, this is a model. And then two, as we started to start a R&D process within Dewey, Arizona, small plant, to say, how can we break these things down? How effectively can we, you know, make a business model out of this? We ran that for a while, and then we just saw this huge influx of people reaching out and say, well, there is no solution. We hear you're working on this. Great. And then it just, you know, several years ago, we came to Yuma accidentally and said, okay, we need to go full scale plant. Let's start putting some of this technology, and let's get the throughput, because this industry needs throughput. And we designed what would be the current plant today.
Nice. That's so cool. So then, just to clarify, then it's like a minor point, but you then kind of separated and started a separate company. And is the other company still existing, or did you just kind of pivot all to solar?
We pivoted completely. We had to, you know, we had to make a tough choice, as that was a business that was thriving and doing well. And we said, well, what can we do? And we had to kind of pick a lane, right? And we put all our chips in this one. This is the horse. Yeah. This is the winning horse.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's another topic I love to talk about, is discussing what to say no to, basically. I mean, you had something that's working, and I kind of want to go into, you've been essentially, from what I can see, it looks like you've been a bit of an entrepreneur pretty much your whole life. I want to understand maybe a little bit of the mindset when you, whatever your first venture was, like, when did you really pull the plug to go kind of bet fully on yourself? And what was your mindset during that phase of saying, you know what, enough is enough, I'm going to go do it? Or was it just always there?
I think, you know, one of the things is that's always been very fascinating to me about entrepreneurship is, like many things in life, often people put bets on companies, right? And those companies have people. So you're betting on other people, their habits, their direction, their derivatives, their what have you. I've always bet on myself. And the reason that is because if something doesn't work, it's my fault. It's not someone else's fault. And, you know, one of the things is knowing that you are the captain of your own ship, if you will, right? Of your own destiny. That was something that was very appealing to me when I was younger. And, you know, from cutting lawns or, you know, starting a .com online event planning business, promotion business, I love the chase. I love the challenge. It always spoke to me. So I was always going to, you know, be that crazy person that always bet on themselves, even if everyone was betting against me.
And then at what point do you decide that, you know, I've got something working here, I'm going to keep doing it? Like, how do you tame the voices of, oh, maybe I go start something new? Because if you want to start something new, it's usually just like kind of in you. So how do you say, hey, wait, I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing, it's working?
I think the immigrant in me tells me that when someone says no, and I think the conversation, when something is difficult, run towards it, not away from it. And that tells you, because most people will not do it. They will not want to run towards the fire. You look at law enforcement or you to firefighters, they run towards the fire. They know the metrics. They know the likelihood is that they may not get out of it. But there's something exciting about that. And I don't know if that's the entrepreneurial bug in me. I'm like, no, if people are afraid to tackle this, let's tackle. There's a challenge here. And there's a reward at the end of this if you can figure this out.
Yeah, no, this is great. Let's talk a bit about the technology. I don't really know how to ask about this because I have no clue how it works, but could you give us a high-level summary of how your recycling or refurbishing processes actually work without obviously disclosing things you can't, but just give us a summary so people can understand conceptually?
Yeah, I mean, this is not any new information. This is all readily available on the internet. There's several different ways of recycling solar panels, and one of them being thermal, one of them being electrostatic, one of them being chemical and mechanical, right? We took a hybrid model. We took a little bit of all of these different processes to do that. The main difference to point out is we're going in this with a machete and not a butter knife, because the sheer numbers, you have to do it to scale. You have to have throughput. And the industry right now collectively is doing one per minute, one per 90 seconds, one panel per, you know, 90 seconds or a minute or so. We're at 10 per minute. And we did that and designed that system and process in mind because we understood that this is going to be a much bigger problem. And I think it's important to point out that this is not like e-waste. This is not like a laptop or an iPhone. This will take hundreds of thousands, if not millions of square footage to just house this material. And you have to be able to process at a very high frequency. So our lines, our technology, our process was always geared towards that high throughput.
And do you think that you, despite being, you know, 10 times better than the average in the space, that you have a lot of room to go up still?
Absolutely. I think that the industry as a whole is growing and moving so quickly. There are, I believe in the next 2 to 5 years, you're going to see some new applications, some new methods of being able to extract more value back on the commodity end. And I think that we're going to increase throughput. We will.
Okay. And how much of this process is kind of novel technology or innovation on that side versus just pure like, hey, we got here first and we're going to be so good at this in the supply chain. Like, can you break down the strategic components of the business, the moat for, I guess, if you will?
Sure. I mean, I think that there is some Frankensteining, if you will, of borrowing techniques and ideas from other industries. But I do think there is an IP element of it as well. Although I can't deep dive fully into it, there are some pieces, right? So the magic sauce. So I do believe there's some IP involved as well. If you're trying to, you know, sustain and be a player within the space, you need to constantly innovate. And that simple tweak, that little adjustment can mean the difference.
And a business like yours, there is no real commercialization path where you just sell the IP to do this to other people, right? It because of the nature of it being such a supply chain driven business and all these things, like, is it necessary that you actually build the plans, you take care of it, and you handle the whole process? Or could you just license out your IP later on?
You could, and that's a model I've seen within other industries people do with the whole licensing model. I think it's difficult to track. If you speak to any type of IP attorney or patent attorney, they will tell you enforcing it is extremely difficult because yeah. I mean, you're behind closed doors. How do you know what the real numbers are? I think for us, it's something that we're looking to scale, build a business, offer a service to the utility, asset owners, developers alike, the larger asset owners. And I think that one of two things are going to happen to segue into the question I think you're going to ask. One, you're either going to be acquired, or you're going to acquire other people within the supply chain so that you're vertically integrated and adding yet more value.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting that there's so many paths that you could go. I mean, that any business that involves supply chain is very difficult, right? And I think a lot of people underestimate that, especially if they've not built a business that involves supply chain. So I wasn't sure if you were going to try to license the IP or maybe just build hardware and then sell to other people. Because if you think about this problem, right, maybe it's small-ish now. But if you're talking about the numbers you mentioned at the beginning, the overall trajectory of the market is huge. And depending on how good you are, you can only scale so fast, right? Even if you're the best, you can only scale globally so quickly. So maybe right. Partner with other people or like you said, maybe do some acquisitions. But obviously, we'll maybe come back to this in a couple of years and talk to you about the strategy there.
Right.
One thing I did want to, you mentioned it earlier, of working with manufacturers to give them feedback. How open and receptive have they been to talking to you about the end of life stuff and how can they make it better and things of that nature?
Surprisingly very open. My mind is blown. I think that they see the writing on the wall. They see that for solar to be a sustainable and successful business model, they need to bring all of the asset owners into the conversation. Mm-hmm. Because again, I don't have to tell you this. There's so many naysayers out there saying, well, what about waste? Or what about, you know, what about this consumerism that takes place within the latest and greatest and getting new panels? And I think that if, you know, the story of solar, if it can be told from a very circular standpoint, and if you are impacting other underdeveloped parts of the country and the world and giving access, it has probably one of the best supply chain stories for any product out there today.
Yeah. I sure hope that is also true for batteries. But I don't know. I'm not a chemist, so I don't know how that's going to work, but I really hope that is possible. Okay, great. And then I think we've already touched on this. I wanted to ask basically the model, but we've really covered that, I think. So in terms of where you're at today, scale-wise, what's the input and output that you're getting roughly, if you're willing to share kind of these numbers, just to get an idea of, so people understand the scale today?
So, you know, I think, you know, our goal here, and I can't comment to it exactly, but I think our goal here today is to do about 500,000 panels this year. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean? I think that, you know, with our current process, we're able to manage 7,500 panels per day. We can process 7,500 panels within this location. To put it in perspective for you, let's take our process. That is what I consider to be one of the more superior processes out there. The throughput is there. If we opened up three more locations throughout the US, we would only solve 25% of the problem. So I just want you to sit that with that for a second. So I think that what is going to happen to your you know, conversation is there's going to be a lot of collaboration. There's going to be different collection points, different processors involved, different parts of this supply chain. There will be businesses that emerge from this industry. And so one of the things that I'm excited about is that within the next 3 to 5 years, especially in the next 3 to 5 years, we have to scale this, you know, four times where we're currently at to continue with the ultimate goal. We understand that we can't be 100% of the market, but we do understand that even if we took 50%, which is, you know, a very big number, I mean, you know, is it possible? Absolutely. But it's going to take a lot of capital. It's going to take a lot of collaboration.
No, I mean, I think that it's just already amazing to see when you're doing 500,000 panels a year. I mean, that's already huge, right? Because I should say we're getting to the point where most of the founders we talk to are later along in their journey on the pod, but there's a lot of people who are talking about the ideas, right? And they still have a long ways to go before it's considered really commercial. So I really appreciate having you on to discuss something that you're actually doing something about it today. To get to where you are, what have been the biggest roadblocks in achieving this?
I think, you know, R&D, we've tried so many different things, like many other firms out there that are now coming into the space. I think labor, I think logistics, as the US is a massive size of just open space, and getting those assets to us. And, you know, I think that as we scale this and we move along, I think capital will be the next conversation. Resources, you need capital to scale.
That was a question I wanted to ask you, because this is not necessarily a straightforward model that I'm super familiar with. So what was your fundraising process? Did you bootstrap this? Were you able to just raise debt to build your facility? Can you talk a little bit about the funding model of how you grew from kind of the early days to now?
No, absolutely. So to get to where we, you know, where we're today, it's all self-funded. I funded this project myself. I mean, bootstrapped mm-hmm. it. I, you know, looking nice. At, you know, taking the other business and pivoting to this one, you're looking at it.
So that's even including the facility build out. Like, did you need to borrow to build that? I mean, cause that's like a pretty big CapEx layout.
It is. We had to get very crafty and work with our vendors and, ask for terms and, make people squirm a little bit. And, so all of it, but at the core of it, it's all self-funded.
I love this, man. This is great. This is like, it's very, I know, rare. I'm nuts. I mean, you and I, we like it. Some people can say you're crazy, but I think it's really good to see, genuinely bootstrapped companies in the space, right? It's just not common that you see this type of thing. It's very difficult. And it'd be interesting to see. We can talk about this in the future with you, but you mentioned the potential challenge next being capital. I wouldn't personally, from my perspective of the market, I don't think it's going to be too difficult because there's a lot of these new funds trying to help companies like yours with folk funding. I know it's not necessarily totally folk, but getting to those perspectives and raising debt to build facilities. It's obviously not a great interest rate market, but that's a conversation for another time. But this is cool. So I guess you talked a little bit about labor being difficult, but could you speak broadly to talent and how you acquire talent, how you build culture with something like this? Because this is, I mean, the way I visualize it, maybe I'm wrong about this, but it's kind of more of like a blue collar type of work. And how do you get these people to be really interested in this space? Because, where I come from, a lot of the blue collar people I talk to, they'd be like, solar, climate, no, not interested, right? Can you talk about that?
One of the things that we've found with a place like Yuma, Arizona, it's an agro town. It's a military and agro town. And one of the things that we identified early on is these individuals were working in very grueling, tough situations, settings in fields, doing hard labor. And when you can say to someone, hey, you can jump on a forklift or you can work in an environment that has a swamp cooler, it's not as brutal, it's a little bit labor intensive, and they have the ability to climb up the ranks fairly quickly, it is appealing. So that talent pool is there. I think the bigger conversation is, how do you merge these two ends of the business? So you have, admin team or more creative people, working within a blue collar kind of environment. That is definitely been more of a challenge for us, I know. And to be very frank, one of the things that I'm looking at is filtering and always looking for better and better talent from the standpoint that, this is, people like to think that this is a family, right? You're creating a culture of family. This is actually a sports team. So you want the best players on the field, right? And there may come a time where I'm going to have to step off the field. There might be someone that's better suited, right, to do that. And so we have to look at talent. We have to put the best players on the field. And I think that's something that's an ongoing goal and initiative for us to always get the best people. People are the three P's: people, process, and product. And people are at the most important ingredient.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's very, it's good to hear. And there's not a lot of founders that I meet that have the humility to admit that they may not be the best person for the job at some point. So that's great to hear. I'm sure if you ever go to raise money, your investors would love that. So this is good. I think it's, I don't know if this is a question to ask you, but I like to think about it. So I'll mention it. I think it's quite fascinating, the idea of when you're designing innovation, and especially in clean tech and climate tech, to think about the talent force, especially when you're looking at, you need to provide a lot of jobs. We're not just talking about a couple developers going out and finding land and like kind of this cowboy mentality. We're talking about manufacturing jobs, a lot of them. Designing your innovation and your machinery in a way that you can upskill most people to do it within a pretty short period of time. I don't think a lot of people calculate this. They're like, oh, we're going to have these machines that there's people out there, these technicians know how to do it, but you got to then convince those technicians to move across the country, or who knows, right? Depending on the talent pool. So I think that's maybe just something to float out there. I don't know if you have any particular comments on it. If you don't, we can go to my final question.
No, I think, when do you want to come over? It seems like you have so many of these things. I think you've identified key, potential blind spots. Yes, you're absolutely right. I'd love to say Yuma is, Nirvana, but look, it's, it, it definitely has its challenges, as you know, the talent pool, some people are willing to give it a try, but it's not for everybody.
Yeah. I think it's just sometimes difficult. Not a lot of people can think the consequences beyond. I'm only lucky because I get to talk to a lot of people on this podcast, right? So I get to hear their problems, right, and experience it without going through it myself. Very cool. The last major question I want to ask you, you talked a little bit about there's going to be collaboration to make this work. Supply chain's difficult. Logistics are difficult. Do you have any particular view on ideas that are, let's call them like sweaty startup ideas, like blue collar ideas, for people to go and support the future of this industry in the climate tech space, right? That we're like, okay, I don't have, like, I'm not some, you know, data person. I don't know software, but I can go build a business, a small business doing this to support the supply chain in the future. Do you have any ideas for that based on, you know,
absolutely, where you see things? Absolutely. So let's just talk about 70 to 80% of the weight of a solar panel, which is glass, right? Mm-hmm. So glass does not have a huge return, and it's heavy and it's bulky and it's, you know, it's dirty, right? I think that more industries that come to the table with solutions around that raw commodity, with especially within the US, you're going to find a major solution to something. So, you know, I think it's very ambitious to say that we're going to take all the glass and we're going to put it back into solar panels. I would like to think that I hate to use the word problem, but the sheer throughput or volume of glass that's going to hit the US market, there are going to be several entrepreneurs that are going to say, you know what, I'm going to develop a product out of this, and different qualities of that glass. And where you have that value, and by the way, there are people currently working on it right now. I think there's a business idea.
Yeah, I love that. We should probably talk another time. I love to come up with the ideas for this space, because it's part of the reason I got so interested in the first place in climate. Was we're reinventing everything, essentially. We're going to make it everything in a sustainable way. When you break the mindset that you make, you use, and you toss it, and you change that to how can we reuse things? How can we just do everything in a greener way? You have to reinvent the whole world effectively. I know some people don't like the term reinvent because it includes risk in the description, but that is why I'm so excited for this, right? There's so much opportunity for people who are thinking ahead and who can build the next thing. But just as a last thing, like what else would you leave us with, and where can people reach you?
So I think that we need more young people like yourself to get involved, not only spread the good word, but help us come up with additional resources to keep this material right within this ecosystem. So to ship this off to another place, you know, so many resources are needed right here. So this concept of urban mining going out and disrupting ecosystems. And we're seeing, and people don't realize how much effect it has on global affairs, right? Geopolitical scenarios that, you know, conflicts that happen within different parts of the world, they're happening because of natural resources. Let's find one less excuse. We have some of these raw commodities that come out of these assets here. Let's start there. Let's start, as the alchemist, right, taught us, it's right in our backyard. Let's start there. So I leave you with that. And if any of the folks in your community want to reach out, they can find me through werecyclesolar.com. And we would be more than happy to engage and have further discussions.
Awesome. Thanks so much for coming on, Adam. This is really fun. I have been looking forward to this one for a while. And we'll definitely, you know, track your success as you continue to go up and to the right, hopefully, mostly. Obviously, there's always dips, but, you know, mostly up and to the right directionally, right?
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Hey there. Welcome to the takeaway sections of the show. As a reminder, we do this to share a bit of our insight into what the guest said and what stood out to us, because we end up kind of pattern matching since we do dozens of these interviews. So let's get into it. The first thing that stood out to me from our conversation with Adam was that at the macro level, there were several things that have happened in the solar panels space, the production space, that would not have been anticipated when the industry started to boom. Specifically, I'll mention a couple. Specifically, that upgrades were happening sooner than expected because of how much better the new panels were. So developers were taking off the old panels just because the new panels were hypothetically, you know, let's say twice as more efficient and could produce more energy, which would boost the returns of the project. Despite there being shorter lifespan of the panels than anticipated in many cases, the projects themselves are actually still making a sufficient return to be valuable to the project owners and the investors. And the third thing was that the secondary market created an opportunity for project owners to make a kind of back-end return when it was anticipated as a cost, right? A cost to recycle, a cost to dispose of. And in many cases, if you refurbish, you can actually sell those panels in a secondary market for a discount, obviously, but still making some return rather than having a cost on your hands. So, you know, the reason that I point this out and the reason it stands out to me is let's keep pursuing innovation. We will figure out creative ways to recycle, reuse, and create future value across the clean tech and climate tech space. I mean, a lot of people are always ready to say, hey, that's not going to work. What are you going to do with these things when they're done? Let's just pursue it and see what happens, because we've got an example here where three incredible kind of outcomes happen where no one would have really anticipated this specific outcome, at least not the average person, right? The second overall point that I took away was what they are doing is setting up essentially a format for clean tech OEMs, whether that's, you know, energy hardware producers or something else in the clean tech space, to take feedback from the people handling the end of life kind of aspect of their products. So I do think my point from this one was that we may see a large kind of boom in the reverse logistics space across manufacturing broadly, but specifically with clean tech, because once they start to do this, others will catch on and say, okay, why can't we do this as well? And, you know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this is already happening a lot in the space. Feel free to reach out and correct me. The third point that I was really fascinated by, and I asked him this, I didn't plan to, so I think he was caught off guard maybe a little bit, but was the sweaty, I'll call it the sweaty climate startup opportunity. From the sounds of it, there is a huge opportunity in the kind of materials handling, logistics, and upcycling sectors where, let's call them, you know, non-science people, non-PhDs, will have a lot of value creation opportunity at their hands, so they can also participate in this clean tech and climate tech revolution. It's not just for the scientists. It's not just for the people who, you know, are wicked smart or know something really technical. This is for everybody. So let us know what you think. Go to the comments section of Substack and tell us what you think. We'll have a discussion. You can let us know in the YouTube comments as well. Really appreciate you guys tuning in. Have a good one.